And now on the Podcast Network.
G'day, you're on the pod with Mick and Ken from the G'day World Podcast.
Hello, Cameron.
Hello, Aubrey.
Hello. So, I wonder what I'm doing wrong. It's almost certainly my fault. Because I could hear you fine. What could I be doing wrong? You're an experienced Skype user, and I've used it about twice.
Mate, it could be anything from the mute button pressed on your microphone through to it not being plugged in through to audio settings in Skype. Unfortunately, it's not really as straightforward as it should be.
Yeah. Okay, here we are anyway.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, Aubrey, for the audience out there who are just listening in, I'm going to attempt to describe who you are and what you do, but please feel free to correct me should I make a total balls up of it.
Okay.
Now, based on the information that I have in front of me, you're currently employed in the Department of Genetics at the University of Cambridge in Cambridge in the United Kingdom. Is that correct?
That's definitely correct.
Excellent. And you'd be about 42?
I'm exactly 42, in fact.
Exactly 42. Now, I'm very excited about having you on the show tonight, but because for the last, 15 years probably, whenever somebody's asked me what my goals are in life, one of them has always been immortality. Or usually when we get into the discussion, I say, look, I'd like to be able to choose the time and place of my death, and I fully intend to live at least 500 to 1,000 years. Now, you actually doing research, and you believe you're going to be able to extend the average human life to 5,000 years, is that correct?
Well, I think the work that I do will allow us to live indefinitely, and the current consequence of that would be a lifespan in the region of 1,000 years. I normally suggest that I think people will probably live in the region of around 5,000 years on average, possibly more. But that's really because of how people will react to the availability of indefinitely long lifespans. I think that people are going to become more risk-averse, and so therefore they're going to die less often than they do now of things like crossing the road carelessly.
Okay. So you actually think that once people realise they can live a long time, they'll be more appreciative of life and try and extend it as long as possible?
That's right.
Well, I'm really excited about this because for the last 10 or 15 years, whenever I've had this conversation with people, the vast, vast majority of people look at me like I'm an absolute lunatic. And even though I try and explain to them that, hey, look, I've read lots of books on what's happening in genetics and nanotechnology and reverse engineering of DNA and RNA, et cetera, they still look at me like an absolute crackpot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not to say that scientists working at Cambridge probably haven't had their share of crackpots over the last couple of hundred years, but you're actually a scientist of quite good standing. And can you explain to people what the study of biogerontology is? Have I pronounced that correctly?
Yes, you pronounced it perfectly. Well, it's really the study of what aging is. I don't normally call myself a biogerontologist. I normally call myself a biomedical gerontologist. So there's a subtle distinction, but it's quite an important one. Really, biogerontologists are mainly interested in simply studying aging as a phenomenon, as curiosity, in the same way that scientists study, galaxies or whatever. They're not so concerned about doing anything about aging. They're more concerned about understanding what aging is. I'm interested in doing something about it, as you said. And so that's why I call myself a biomedical gerontologist. I'm not a clinical gerontologist, in the sense. What they are is they're people who use technology that's already available to to make aging as tolerable as possible. I'm interested in technology that isn't available yet, and in developing things that can do much better than we can now.
Now, did you develop the term of SENS?
Yes.
Okay. Can you explain to the audience what that stands for?
Right. SENS. It stands for Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence. Which is very long, and it was sort of slightly on purpose that I invented something quite so unmemorable because I thought it would be journalist proof. but It has a technically quite precise meaning, which is useful, of course. Senescence is the word that gerontologists like to use when they talk about aging, when they want to make sure that people understand that they're only talking about the things that are bad about aging, the physiological and cognitive decline, and not things like, you know, getting more knowledgeable or becoming more intolerant of modern popular music, things like that. The word negligible senescence was introduced about 15 years ago by a top gerontologist called Tuck Finch. And what that means is basically senescence that is so slow that you can't measure it. So if you look at the distribution of how old individuals are in a population, typically not a population of humans, a population of animals, then you can tell something about how rapidly they're aging from that distribution, just basically from how many of them there are that are of each age. And you can, a population that isn't aging at all has a particular sort of signature in that distribution. And if the population that you're looking at is very close to that, then that's called negligible senescence. So I invented the term engineered negligible senescence simply to mean the process of converting a species that does age into one that doesn't.
And so how does that, what does that mean in plain English? Now, from my reading of biology over the years, senescence is quite often used as a term that relates to cellular death and apoptosis. Is that right?
That is right. It's used for that as well. But it's certainly used for organisms as well. So I'm talking about it in respect of organisms.
Okay. Now, there are lots of theories that I've read over the years around how we can extend our lives significantly, including calorie restriction, which is something I've been practicing for the last 10 years. What's your approach to life extension?
Right. I actually don't think calorie restriction is going to work very well for humans. My take is that the evolutionary pressure to evolve or to maintain, in fact, the genetic pathways that cause aging to slow down when one has nutrient deprivation, have a smaller effect on longer-lived species than on shorter-lived species. So mice can live maybe 30 or 40% longer than normal if you feed them not very much. Nematode worms can live 3 or 4 times as long as normal if you feed them nothing at all. They go into this state called GALA that you may have heard of. I think that the evidence at the moment, albeit rather circumstantial, is that humans will be a sort of extrapolation of that generalization and will only get a couple of years out of calorie restriction. Now, that's no reason not to do it. I think that first of all, a couple of years is not nothing, but secondly, there's now very good evidence that calorie restriction is good for your health, especially if you're in any way prone to getting heart disease or other standard age-related diseases, diabetes, for example.
Certainly,
so I don't in any way discourage people from doing calorie restriction, but I do think it's important to realize that the evidence at the moment is that in terms of actual lifespan, it's probably not going to give us 30% the way it gives mice. What I'd like to do instead is take, well, this is really why I call it engineered negligible senescence. I like to take an engineering approach to this, which basically means repairing damage periodically as and when it occurs, as opposed to stopping it from happening in the first place. And what I mean by damage, I mean the various microscopic changes, molecular and cellular changes that happen throughout life that build up in our bodies and are eventually bad for us. The things I'm talking about are, for example, mutations, indigestible aggregates like amyloid in ourselves and outside ourselves, stiffening of tissues like the artery or the lens of the eye that become less elastic and therefore less well, those sorts of things. These are things that are happening as ongoing side effects of metabolism throughout our lives, even from before we're born. But they're basically harmless until middle age or thereabouts, because they have to accumulate to a certain level before the body starts to have difficulty coping with them. So my approach is to basically fix up these things periodically so that they never reach. You don't have to fix them completely, but you just have to fix them sufficiently well that they never reach this threshold, this level of abundance that is pathogenic.
Are you suggesting then that aging and death is a result of a lot of these little things building up until they have like a straw breaking the camel's back effect?
Basically, yes. And this is not really my suggestion. This is really, I mean, most gerontologists would agree about this, that there are these various types of things that go wrong with us to a gradually accumulating degree, and eventually they translate into age-related diseases and frailty and, you know, all sorts of functional decline. This is not really controversial. What's controversial is that we might be able to repair all of these things sufficiently comprehensively to actually extend lifespan.
Okay, so how would we repair them? I read something in Reuters today about some research being done at MIT with nanotech anti-cancer smart bombs that they've been testing on mice. Is this the sort of thing that you see becoming available over the course of the next 10, 20 years?
Yeah, that research at MIT is pretty cool, certainly. I think it's probably going to take at least that long to get things like that to work. The approaches that I look at in terms of time frames, I hope that they'll be subject to proof of concept within 10 years in mice. And I think if that's true, and if they really work to the extent of extending very substantially the lifespan of mice that are already middle-aged before we start the therapy, which is the critical thing, then they'll be translated to humans as quickly as possible. And I think we have maybe a 50% chance of doing that within 15 years from that time. So in other words, within 25 years or so from now. But, of course, that's a lot of work to do in the meantime, and it could take longer if we are unlucky. The sorts of therapies, you know, stem cell therapies are going to be heavily involved, gene therapies, and also more traditional things like vaccines and, you know, normal drugs.
So, apart from yourself, how many other scientists around the world are working on these sorts of aging reversal processes?
Pretty much all of the things that I talk about that I think are important components of these therapies are being worked on one way or another in laboratories around the world. Most of them are being worked on for reasons that have nothing to do with aging per se, as it happens. They're generally focused either on age-related diseases or sometimes not even on aging, sometimes just on you know, things that have nothing to do with aging. But I've seen the relevance of these things to you know, how they fit into the grand scheme that I've been promoting.
And you can see them all converging over the course of the next few decades?
That's right.
I remember reading quite a bit about telomeres or telomeres back in the late 90s. There was a lot of excitement about telomeres. Can you explain where the current research on telomeres is up to?
Sure. Yeah, so telomeres, for those of your listeners who don't know, are the special sequences, DNA sequences, that we find at the end of chromosomes. And the biological purpose of the telomere is to protect the end of the chromosome. In particular, to protect the end of the chromosome from the DNA repair machinery of the cell, which sounds a bit paradoxical, but what's going on there really is that chromosomes constantly break. They get damaged by radiation and so on, and this sometimes breaks the chromosome in two, and the cell has machinery to put the chromosome back together again. But of course, when a chromosome is broken in two, you've got two, you know, ends of DNA molecules that have to be put together. So it's important that the cell should be able to know that it shouldn't just stitch two different chromosomes together end to end. That would be very bad for subsequent cell division and so on. So the telomere is a special sequence that the cell recognizes as not to be stitched together. And the thing about the telomeres is they get shorter when cells die, because the mechanism of DNA replication, which is very complicated really, isn't able to replicate right up to the end of a chromosome. It always loses a little bit at the end. And so every time the cell divides, of course the DNA has to replicate, and a little bit is lost. Eventually the cell gets into a state where the telomere is so short that it doesn't look sufficiently like a telomere anymore. The special sequences are almost gone. And if that happens, the chromosomes get stitched together in the way I just described, and the cell can't divide anymore. So that's the cause of this thing that was discovered by Len Hayflick back in the early 60s called cell senescence. And it's quite an interesting phenomenon. And for a while, people genuinely thought that this might have a very direct effect on senescence of organisms, on aging. because they thought, well, okay, self divide, they'll be getting increasingly unable to divide, and that will be bad for the tissue, and for the organism. We now know that that's almost certainly not happening at all. That cells that are able to exhibit this senescence behavior in cell culture do not actually divide in the body anything like as much as they would need to, as they need to in order to get into that state. They have long enough telomeres to last them for a whole lifetime. Now, there are some cells that do divide a lot more often, but those cells don't actually have this telomere shortening problem. And the reason they don't is that they express a special enzyme called telomerase, which counteracts the shortening that goes on during DNA replication. Telomerase basically stitches on extra new copies of this special sequence that makes the telomere a telomere. They don't express very much of this enzyme, but they express enough to be able to carry on dividing without telomere shortening throughout our life. We're talking about stem cells in the blood, for example, and in the gut and the skin and so on. So it's pretty clear that telomere shortening has nothing to do with normal aging. There are certain situations in which telomere shortening does have pathogenic effects, but they're really secondary to other pathogenic effects that have caused cells to divide excessively. You see this, for example, on the surface of an atherosclerotic plaque. The cells on there, the endothelial cells, divide a great deal, and we can see telomere shortening there, and it may be that the cells have divided so much that they're having difficulty carrying on dividing. But that's a special case. It's sort of secondary to something else that's going on in aging. There are other ways in which a cell can get into the state that's rather similar to what happens when its telomeres get too short in cell culture. And this phenomenon does happen in the body. Basically, we think it's something to do with chromosome breakage, which, as I say, is something that makes new chromosome ends. If a cell has too many chromosome breaks, it gets confused and it basically shuts down. It basically decides that it's the better part of valor just to go into a sort of quiescent state. But this quiescent state may be toxic. The cell that goes into this state may conceivably express secrete proteins that are bad for cells nearby. And this is an interesting theory that's being looked at quite hard at the moment.
Fascinating stuff. And what other sorts of research are you most excited about that's happening out there? What's the cutting edge of anti-aging technology?
Well, the SENSE program consists of seven different areas, seven different types of molecular and cellular change that go on, damage that accumulate. And each of them has its own way of fixing it. So I look at an awful lot of different things all at the same time. But certainly stem cell therapies play a large part in several of my proposals, and so do gene therapies. There's quite a lot going on in the gene therapy world at the moment. One thing that as anyone who follows the news on such matters knows, one thing that we have to develop is better ways to be able to get genes into cells and into our chromosomes in particular places, rather than going in random places that might do more harm than good, because that phenomenon, when things go into the wrong place, can have effects like giving the patient cancer. And this is actually the reason why some gene therapy trials have been stopped, because it happened. So there are quite a few labs around the world working on various highly creative ways to exploit the capacity of certain viruses and certain bacterial viruses called bacteriophages to go into just particular places, so that you know they're not going to go into places that you don't want them to.
Fantastic. Okay, can you explain to us about the Methuselah Mouse Prize? I believe you're the gentleman behind that.
I'm one of the gentlemen behind that, certainly. Methuselah Mouse Prize was initiated basically as a collaboration between me and an American entrepreneur called David Goebel. I'm the chairman, he's the CEO. Of the Methuselah Foundation, which is 501c3, the charity that runs it. The Methuselah Mouse Prize is an effort aimed at raising the profile of life extension research, at making people more interested in it and more excited by it. And the logic is that people often turn off when they hear science for more than 10 seconds, but they do have much more of an interest in things like world records and prizes. And so what we did was we just set up this prize, which you get if you create a mouse that lived longer than any other mouse has ever done. The way it works is that the amount you get is you don't get the whole of the money we have. You get a proportion of it that depends on how much you beat the previous record by. So there's always some left. It's a sort of ongoing prize. And it seems to work. You know, people are very interested in this. We have a website, of course, mprize.org. You can go there and give us a bit of money. And at the moment, we have about £150,000 actual cash in the bank that's been given to us by donors. We have pledges of about 10 times that, about £1.5 million. What's important to say, though, is that even if you've only got $10, please give it to us, because the number of independent donors, which is currently up around a couple of hundred, that actually matters just as much as the total prize fund in terms of the you know, the publicity value, in terms of communicating to people that this matters and that it's something that it would be good for them to be doing research on. So, it's a great success.
Are you getting support from government funding in the UK?
Not yet. I think it'll be a while before governments and other really establishment institutions put serious money into life extension research. Certainly because at the moment there aren't any votes in it. There's too much ambivalence in society about whether life extension is what we want to do anyway. And, you know, while there are no votes in it, governments tend not to be terribly interested.
Now, I mean, that leads, I guess, into the social consequences of life extension and some of the pushback that people have. You know, I guess one of the common responses I've had from people over the last decade when I talk about this is, oh, I wouldn't want to live forever. You know, it's not something that would be of interest to me. And I suspect that's often because, you know, we all know people who have lived to their 90s or 100, or we see them on television, and they always look extremely frail and their quality of life is not very high. But of course, I then have to explain to people that that's not what we're talking about when we talk about life extension, right? Because we're suggesting that your quality of life, your health, will be at optimal levels during this period. It's not like you're going to spend the next 900 years living in a wheelchair.
Precisely. And the thing is, you know, it's pretty curious that you have to explain that, really, because we've been saying, look, everybody says that. Everybody knows that it's impossible to keep people alive in a frail state. Being frail is risky, and it always will be. You'll always be susceptible to, you know, falls or infections or whatever, much more than you were when you were youthful, if you get frail. So it's clear that the only way to extend life is to extend healthy life. And, you know, it's not just me that's saying this. Every gerontologist says this, and we've been saying it for the past 50 years, and yet you still have people clinging to this crazy reason to be not interested in life extension. You know, it's clear that there's some sort of psychological resistance that is being, in some way, supported by clinging to these things that people already know the answer to.
Yeah, one of the other pushbacks that I'm sure you get all the time is this idea of overpopulation. Well, where will everyone live?
Right.
What's your response to that?
Yeah, this is really quite a hard one. I don't think there is going to be an easy answer to this. Some of my colleagues like to say, well, it won't be a problem. You know, birth rates are already falling across the world, and or across the developed world anyway, and that's just going to continue, so everything's going to be all right. Some people say, well, it's going to be okay because we'll all emigrate into space. Things like that. I don't actually think that any of these answers work terribly well. I think that in the end, when we have these life extension therapies, we will genuinely face a bit of a dilemma between, essentially, a high death rate or a low birth rate. In other words, either we're going to have to have considerably fewer kids than we'd like, or we're going to have to abandon these therapies and go back to aging the way we do now. The thing is, though, that's okay, because that's a choice that humanity will make in the future, one way or another. And I think it's pretty likely that we'll choose to go for the indefinite lifespans and not very many kids. But I could be wrong, and it could be, in fact, that some sections of society choose one option and some choose another. And that's fine, you know, very much as, for example, the Amish in the US have rejected a variety of technologies, and that's okay, they live, you know, we're not at war with them. So I think, you know, that's okay. And therefore, I think that from our point of view today, if we're deciding whether we should develop these therapies, it's clear that we have a duty to develop them as soon as possible so as to give humanity of the future that choice as soon as possible. Essentially, if we prevaricate, if we don't develop these therapies, then what we're doing is we're imposing our values, our choices, on the future. We're saying to the future that you've got to carry on aging the way we're aging, and we're denying them the choice of longer life, which they might have chosen. And we have no right to make that choice for them.
And in fact, this isn't a new issue, right? We've been extending human lifespan forever. That's what medical research has always done, hasn't it? I mean, our lifespan today, the average 70 or 80 year lifespan, is twice what it was 500, 1,000 years ago.
That's right. In fairness, actually, it's a relatively new phenomenon. We didn't really have much impact on average lifespan until maybe a couple of hundred years ago. That was when it started to increase, and it's been increasing at an accelerating rate over the past century. But, of course, the rate at which it's been increasing has been rather changeable. There was a period especially during the first half of the 20th century, during which average lifespans went up very rapidly. But that was because we basically worked out how to eliminate infant mortality in the Western world, in the developed world. And you know, infant mortality used to be about 30 or 40%, which means 30 or 40% of babies would die before they reached the age of one. Plus, of course, there's a great deal of death in childbirth. And both of these causes of death have been taken down by at least a factor of 10 in the developed world. Now, you can't do that again to infant mortality. You can't increase life expectancy by doing even more to infant mortality because there's so little of it already. The only way we can increase life expectancy now is by dealing with aging. And so the question then is simply, how long will it take us to invent a way of doing that? But you're absolutely right. I mean, the consequences of essentially eliminating infant mortality were, in a lot of ways, rather similar to what the consequences will be of eliminating aging as a cause of death, and in particular the overpopulation. There was, of course, a big population spike, which took a generation or two to be brought under control. And actually, if one thinks about that, it's very interesting to look at how we did that, how we brought it under control, and how ridiculous that would have seemed in advance. You know, you can think in terms of asking people 200 years ago whether they would be happy to wear these ridiculous rubber things whenever they had sex, just in order to have not very many kids. And they would have laughed at you. But in fact, that's what everybody did immediately, more or less, just because...
In fact, 200 years ago, that would have been... You would have had religious reasons why you weren't allowed to do that. They wouldn't even be able to comprehend of the idea of preventing conception.
Well, in principle, of course, we still have religious reasons in many countries, and the country with the lowest birth rate at the moment is Italy, which... of course, it's supposed to be a completely Catholic country.
Yeah, of course, yes. So the other that takes us through to this concept of playing God, which is, I'm sure, another criticism or concern that you're given. But again, that always strikes me as strange. The same people who will suggest that wanting to significantly extend lifespans is playing God are the same people that are going to the doctor as soon as they're sick, they're taking medication, they're going for heart bypass surgery. And yet they don't see the hypocriticalness of that.
Absolutely. And of course, it's not just medical treatment, it's also things like, you know, all other technology. You know, in fact, I think that the opposite is true. I think that it's playing God to accept the world as we find it. Because ultimately, the reason why we invented fire and the wheel and, you know, vaccines and so on is because we are naturally given the ability and also the will, you know, the desire to improve our world, to make it different from how we find it. And you know, so saying that in this particular case we should leave it alone is a bit like telling God that he got it wrong, that he shouldn't have given us the ability or the desire to change our world. So in fact, I would say that it's playing God to avoid doing these therapies.
Or to say that no one else should have the opportunity to extend their lifespan.
Well, that's also true, of course, yes. The question is, should we... just because one person doesn't think that they themselves would want to benefit from it, there's no reason why everyone else shouldn't.
Yeah, I always say, that's fine, you don't want to live forever, that's up to you.
The main answer, of course, to not wanting to live forever is that, no one really wants to live forever in the sense of you don't know what it's going to be like, you just don't know anything about it. The question is, do you want to die anytime soon? And if you're youthful and healthy and generally enjoying life, you probably don't want to die in the next year. And if in a year from now you're still equally youthful and healthy, then you probably still won't want to die, and so on. So, you don't live to 1,000 all in one go. You do it 1 year at a time.
One day at a time, in fact.
That's right.
So how did you get involved in the research of life extension, Aubrey? What led you into this area of research?
Well, my wife is a biologist, and that's how I learned a great deal of biology early on. And gradually I became aware that there wasn't really very much work going on in biogerontology and trying to understand the biology of aging. And out of all the work that was going on, virtually none of it was focused on actually trying to do something about aging. Most of it was, as I was saying earlier, focused more on just understanding it. I thought this was disgraceful. I was very surprised as well, because I'd always thought, since I was a kid, I guess, that it was obvious that aging was, first of all, undesirable, and secondly, potentially fixable. But the only reason there wasn't any progress was because it was a very hard problem, and people would obviously be working on it and doing their best to figure out how to stop it. And it was a great shock to me to discover that this wasn't really true, that most people had this curious ambivalence about the whole thing. I'd never really discussed it when I was a kid. It took me a long time to find out that people were so different about this, just because I thought it was so obvious that I didn't discuss it in the same way that I didn't discuss the color of the sky or whatever. But as soon as I discovered this, it became apparent to me pretty quickly that I really ought to try to help. And I was in a position where I thought I might be able to make a contribution, because I was a researcher already, not in biology, but in computer science. And so I basically, I had the right sort of expertise to be able to do research and to be able to come up with new ideas and so on. And also, coming into a field when you're already experienced in doing research in a completely different field is often quite useful. There are quite a lot of major discoveries that have been made over the years by people who did that. Basically because one comes in sort of unencumbered by conventional wisdom, and you can sort of think out of the box more easily and see where people have been going wrong. So, yeah, that's really... I thought that I might be able to make a contribution, and that's how it happened.
And so what are your forecasts here? It's August 2005. What are the sort of timelines that you're predicting before you're able to significantly extend the lifespan of mice and then go into human trials? When are we likely to see these sorts of sciences come to realization for humans to put into practice?
The first step, as you say, is getting it to work in mice. And the main uncertainty there, in my view, is financial. Really, I need $100 million a year or thereabouts for about 10 years, and if I had that, then I think I would have probably a 90% chance of being able to bring all of these various different treatments to a sufficiently advanced state that they could be applied to mice and they would actually work. And I predict that if they were all applied to the same mouse, then one could get those mice to live a lot longer. But in particular, the critical thing is that the mice would live a lot longer, even though the therapies would only have been initiated when the mice were already middle age. So I normally put numbers on this. I call this milestone robust mouse rejuvenation. And I normally say that the way it's going to work is we'll take mice that have a natural lifespan of about 3 years. That's actually quite long for a mouse. Some strains live that long, but most strains don't. And so that means we're taking mice that are already unusually healthy. That's very good, because if you take mice that are already unusually unhealthy, then, just fixing the problems they've got is not really very convincing. So you take mice that are already unusually healthy, You do nothing to them at all until they're 2 years old. In other words, until they're within 1 year of keeling over. And then I think that if we did all these therapies to them, that would be able to get them to live to their fifth birthday. In other words, it would make them live 3 years more, starting from the point where the therapy started, rather than only 1 year. That's robust mass rejuvenation, and I think that with that sort of investment of funding, we could get there within 10 years. After After that, of course, the question is how to get to humans, and I don't think the main questions then are going to be scientific. I think they're mainly going to be sociological, because my prediction is that once we get these mice, and once we therefore have all gerontologists, not just me, saying that, yes, this is a proof of concept. In other words, that we will, in the foreseeable future, be able to very greatly extend human lifespans of people who are already in middle age when we start. Once that happens, people, of course, will believe the scientific consensus and appreciate that this really is true, that aging is potentially a thing of the past in the foreseeable future. And I don't think that these debates about the about whether it would be a good thing or not are going to last very long in that situation. I think that the only reason we have these, so many people in society have these curious, crazy reasons for thinking that aging is good for us or that we don't want to live indefinitely, is that it's a coping strategy for the situation when aging is inevitable. Because, of course, aging is really ghastly, and the best way to cope with something that's inevitable and ghastly is to figure out some crazy reason for thinking that it's actually a good thing after all, even though it might not look like it, and therefore, you know, you put it out of your mind that way. Once people really realize that it's not inevitable, that whole logic breaks down, and I think that people will see these crazy, stupid reasons for defending aging for what they are. So that means that within a very short amount of time after we get these mice, it's going to be impossible to get elected except on a manifesto commitment to have some sort of Manhattan Project to cure aging as soon as possible. So money won't be any object after that. It's going to cost a very great deal to translate these technologies from mice to humans, but that money is going to be available because people are going to pay for it. It's going to be a real war on aging where people are willing, in fact, eager to embrace high taxation to pay for the research to happen as soon as possible, and also, of course, to pay for the training of the enormous numbers of medical personnel that will be required to actually administer these therapies when they are developed, and indeed to pay for the consumables that will be involved. So I think one has to be very speculative in order to say how long it's going to take, starting from robust mass rejuvenation, before we get to this stage that I call robust human rejuvenation, where we're basically adding 30 or so years to the remaining healthy lifespans of people who are already, let's say, 55. But I think we have a 50-50 chance of getting there within 15 years from the point that we get the mice, so 25 years from now.
So, anyone who's under the age of 50 today has a good chance of getting access to these technologies?
People who are under the age of 50 have a fair chance, yes. I mean, if you're 50 now, then that means you'll be 75 in 25 years' time. And a lot of people are at death's door when they're 75. I think that when these technologies come along in their first versions, it's going to be difficult to apply them to people who are at death's door because, these are going to be strenuous things. You're going to be going into hospital for a month or whatever, getting lots of stem cell therapies and gene therapies and so on, and maybe surgery of various sorts, and this is something that really frail people don't tolerate very well. Of course, the therapies will improve very rapidly after that over the subsequent decades, so as to become better at rescuing people from closer and closer to the brink, so to speak. But I think the people who are going to benefit most from these first therapies will be people who naturally have at least 10 or 15 years of life to go.
So, I'm 34. What are my chances?
Well, if you're 34, that means that you'll be 60 in 25 years' time. So if I get my money soon, and if we therefore meet these timeframes that I'm talking about, then I think we're talking in terms of maybe a 50% chance. But, of course, the better you look after yourself, the better. And the better you're naturally going to live, the better. For all I know, you're one of these elite people who are aging slowly and who would naturally live to 110. And if so, then your chances are a good deal better than 50%. Conversely, you may be someone who's going to keel over at the age of 50 from a heart attack, in which case your chances are not very good.
So we should be taking care of ourselves in the meantime. Oh, yeah. This isn't an excuse to just go on a diet of pizza and Coke and think it's all right. Aubrey's going to take care of it.
That's right. Certainly not yet. You can do that when these therapies arrive, but not yet.
Now, $100 million a year doesn't seem like a lot of money.
You're right.
Have you been hitting up Bill Gates' foundation?
Well, you can't exactly write to billionaires and say, please, Dr. Gates, can you give me $100 million a year for 10 years to cure aging? It's unlikely that they'll see a letter. My approach really is to get in the media a great deal, to get them to see me, you know, to get them to appreciate that these things are becoming possible, and maybe to realize that their money can make a difference, and take it from there. And so I'm quietly hopeful that this sort of thing will happen in fairly short order.
You know, I was reading in the Australian papers today that our government has got $17 billion in the budget this year for military spending, which is basically being spent on taking life rather than extending life.
Yeah.
When you compare that to $100 million a year for research to extend our lives, it just seems ridiculous.
You're so right.
So what can we do, Aubrey? What can the people listening to this show do to support your research and to help you get this $100 million a year and help us all live long, healthy lives?
Well, if you look me up on Google, you can find my website easily enough. And on there I have a page that says, how can you help? And it depends on what sort of person you are, of course, what you do. But I say things like, if you have some spare air miles, donate them to the Methuselah Foundation to help in my travel expenses. If you're a journalist, write about my work. I also say, if you're a journalist, please interview other mainstream gerontologists, preferably very senior and high-profile ones, and ask them what they think about my work. Because, you see, what I'm saying is quite extreme. I say that we're really going to fix aging. I don't say that we're going to develop... I don't say that in 25 years we're going to have aging completely licked. I say we're going to have it sufficiently licked to give us time to lick it progressively better as time goes on. So I have this concept that I like to call life extension escape velocity, where basically we fix aging sufficiently comprehensively in 25 years maybe to give us an extra 30 years to fix it a bit better and to give us another 50 years to fix it a bit better still and so on. And this is a pretty extreme conclusion that lots of people alive today are going to live to 1,000 or whatever. A lot of my colleagues recoil from that a bit. They think it's politically dangerous to be allying themselves with that sort of thing, and they don't know the details of the proposals I'm making of how we might do this either. And so a lot of my colleagues, when journalists ask them about my work, they tend to be a bit negative. But if you probe a little bit and you ask them, well, why don't you think this is going to work, then they don't have an answer. And so I think one thing that journalists can do is make my colleagues feel a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that they don't actually know why the proposals I'm putting forward wouldn't work, despite the fact that they have a sort of instinct that they wouldn't work. This has actually developed into something that was launched yesterday called the Sense Challenge. A magazine in America called Technology Review has actually offered $20,000 to any gerontologist who can convince an independent panel of experts that my ideas are so crazy as to be not worth discussing.
Excellent. I mean, I've seen this with scientists over the last 10 years. Whenever the subject of cloning or stem cell research comes up, they always seem to be distancing themselves from anything that could be seen to be threatening to the powers that be or extreme, because they want to maintain their existing sources of funding, right?
That's right. It's pathetic, isn't it? But hey, they've got families.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I can understand it, but it normally, I normally translate that, not that they don't agree with the possibilities of the research, just that they're playing their cards very close to their chest.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay, excellent. So what you're saying is that this challenge has been put out by Technology Review magazine, and to date, no one's been able to come forward and dispute what you're saying?
Well, it was only put out yesterday, so that's, in fairness, there hasn't really been much time. But I'm pretty confident that no one's going to come forward, that's right.
But you've been you've been putting forward this vision for quite a few years now, and no one's come forward to be able to counter it scientifically in that time?
That's right.
Excellent. Well, Aubrey, I don't want to take you away from your research any longer.
Okay.
Every half hour counts. But thank you very much for coming on. I'm certainly going to be doing everything I can to promote the research that you're doing and trying to help you raise that money, because it's very exciting. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and explain it to us in detail.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great night and good luck.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Well, there you go. That was Aubrey de Grey. And got to tell you, folks, I'm very excited about that. I have been, you know, sort of reading and keeping up to date with this research for the last 15, 20 years, as I said in the interview. And, you know, everything that Aubrey's saying is being said by other scientists around the world, and there's plenty of books out there. I'll put links to some of them up on the G'day World site. You can go and read it for yourself. There's a number of different foundations out there that are trying to raise awareness of life extension technologies. Check it out. It's very exciting. And as Aubrey said, if his research is right, and all this research that's happening around the world is leading to the outcome that he's predicting, we need to start thinking about it and planning for it today. If there is going to be a massive population explosion, even bigger than the one that's already forecast, as a result of these technologies, we need to start to think about the frameworks today. It's too late to leave it 20 years and then to start thinking about how we deal with the fact that people are living into 200 or 300. What does this mean in terms of our economics? What does this mean in terms of how we support people in third world countries, career choices that people make, etc., etc.? So anyway, this is Cameron. Hope you enjoyed that chat. The quality of the line was a little bit dodgy because I was ringing his landline in London. But hopefully you were able to bear with it. And I'll talk to you again soon. Cheers. Assume the position.